Hello and welcome to the DNW podcast, the show in which we discuss the latest developments in the European technology ecosystem and feature occasional interviews with some of the most interesting people in the industry. My name is Andriy Degler. I am the head of media at DNW.
And I'm Linnea Algren, senior editor here at DNW.
It is Tuesday again and we are recording again. How are you doing, Linnea?
I'm good, thank you. I narrowly escaped getting completely and utterly soaked on my way here. And then when I sat in our morning meeting from the cafe, which I ducked into to escape being completely and utterly soaked, I said I wasn't expecting it to rain, which was to the mirth of my colleagues. Said, how long have you been living here? Really? So that's my little weather update for today. How are you, Andy?
Yeah, about the same. I think I got to the office before, like just between the rain bouts, but the wind was really, really strong today. Yeah. So it's, I think it's still quite strong outside, actually.
I think so. But it seems no one got blown into a canal on their way here this morning. So that's a win.
Yeah, that's a great thing to know, at least. Although I did see things flying around, so if you are somewhere in the Netherlands or just in one of the adjacent countries, maybe be careful with going outside this week because it's not going to get better according to the weather forecast.
Yay.
Exactly. So today's episode, we are going to discuss nicer things, including artificial general intelligence, repairable earbuds, some Wolverine nerdery, drone delivery adoption, and of course, much more. You will also hear an interview with Caroline Villarouge, who is the CEO at EIT Manufacturing. Let's start with a story that we did cover this week. Linnea, what did you decide to highlight?
So it's been a while since we talked about AI.
Yeah, like one episode?
I think a couple. We had flying cars in there.
Oh, yeah, we did. So, yes. Okay.
But permitted. See, so I'm very interested in philosophy of mind, etc. And so I'm very interested in the topic of, or the idea of artificial general intelligence, or AGI. And the last week has really seen the conversation around when AGI is potentially arriving.
I like the word when.
Yeah. If, when, the. But I kick off on a very broad scale with one industry profile after the other, trying to sort of one-up one another and making increasingly bold predictions. It started with NVIDIA's Jensen Huang, who said that AGI will arrive in about 5 years' time. And then Ben Gertzel, who's a computer scientist and AI researcher, and he's usually called the father of AGI because he helped popularize the term. Mm-hmm. He then said it will be here in 3 years.
Oh.
And of course, not one to shy away from controversy and outlandish statements, Elon Musk claims that we will have general artificial intelligence by the end of 2025 or so.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's like end of next year.
Yeah. So that reaction.
No, I mean.
That I could just see on Andriy's face. Is also shared by many people in the industry. And our senior reporter, Thomas McCauley, attended Meta's AI event in London last week. And the company's chief AI scientist, Jan LeCoum, who is a Turing Award winner, among other things, argues that AGI, or at least on the path of large language models, is not even possible.
Mm-hmm. That's a very different end of the spectrum.
Yes, for sure. He's also of the opinion that since human intelligence is nowhere near general, meaning it's something that's very different from a general level intelligence, there isn't even such a thing as AGI.
Mm-hmm.
However, he does say that there could potentially be such a thing as human level AI, albeit very far in the future.
And why is it far in the future?
Well, he pointed to four specific cognitive challenges for developing human-level AI, and these are reasoning, planning, persistent memory, and understanding of the physical world. Now, reasoning and planning are obviously two things that the big AI companies are trying to solve now, even with LLMs. And OpenAI and Meta, for instance, are on the verge of releasing new models, GPT-5 and Llama 3, to be precise, that are specifically, according to product officers, going to show progress on those kinds of capabilities.
Yeah, and there was that model that you talked about recently that was going to get better understanding of physical world, right?
Yes, so that's not an LLM per se. That's a system that an agent, an AI mm-hmm. agent that can indeed learn from its own surroundings. So this ties into also what LeCun was talking about. Because let's say you could get LLMs to reason or plan or even remember, there are ways in which humans perceive reality that are inextricably linked to our cognition and what we call intelligence. And LeCun actually went as far as to call LLMs an off-ramp, a distraction, and even a dead end on the path towards human-level intelligence. And that is because, as he says, most human knowledge and mental processes come from other inputs than language. Right. So large language models only have text mm-hmm. as their input, only language, right? So LeCun's suggestion would be instead to focus on what he calls objective-driven AI systems. And they would learn about the physical world, not just through text data, but through sensors and video feeds, and also learn to understand the impacts, mm-hmm. The impact of its actions. Basically learning through a broad range of experience inputs the same way that humans do. I don't know if you remember, but I think it was a couple of months ago we talked about the mind as something that's embodied and also embedded in the sensory phenomena of the physical world. No?
No, I do remember the conversation, but yeah. It's sometimes it gets too high level for me, so I will probably kindly ask you to remind me what that was about.
So we talked about this in relation to a humanoid robot from a Norwegian startup mm-hmm. called 1X Technologies, which coincidentally is backed by OpenAI. So I wonder what kind of thoughts they have with investing into a system like this, because there's this theory called the four E's of cognition. And this means that the mind is embodied, which means that cognition cannot be fully described in terms of abstract mental processes, but it must involve the entire body of the living system, meaning mm-hmm. brain and body okay. in relationship.
Okay, that's one E.
Yes, that's one E. Second E, it's embedded. So cognition is not an isolated event, but it displays layers of co-determination with physical, social, and cultural aspects of the world. And okay. meaning what kind of cultural framework you grow up in will determine your set of sort of parameters for what reality is.
Yeah.
It's also extended. So this means that we often offload our cognition into either biological beings or non-biological devices to serve a variety of functions that are too difficult to be achieved only by relying on our own mental processes.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's also inactive. So this means that it functions through a set of meaningful relationships that are determined by an adaptive two-way exchange between the biological and phenomenological complexity of living creatures and the environments that they inhabit and actively shape. Essentially, everything that surrounds you, that you are in some form of relationship yeah. with, receiving data, so to speak, input, etc., but that you also shape in your mind through the way that you are observing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm obviously not an AI scientist.
You're getting there.
But it seems to me that any system that would aspire to human-level intelligence and cognition would need to solve at least some of these points, right? And
no, of course.
Obviously, this is not something that LLMs, no matter how useful they may be from a productivity point of view, can achieve. Because right. they are fed text or etc.
In this way, you can call them limited, I suppose. Yeah.
Yes. So I will say that I belong to Camp LeCun in this case. I don't believe that we will see AGI through continuously building larger and larger models with bigger and bigger parameters.
Yeah.
But I believe that there has to be other forms of input, especially these sensory inputs, because so much of what we think of as cognition is determined not necessarily through the intellect, but from other inputs that then arise in our intellect.
No. I think I understand what you mean.
Very philosophical there. I find it incredibly fascinating. I also believe that LLMs are perhaps not the way to go, but I would be very interested in hearing from our readers what they think. What do you think? Do you believe that AGI is possible, or in this case, perhaps human level intelligence then from machines?
Okay. For the purpose of this conversation, yeah, we can say the same thing. But I do think that it's possible. But I would definitely not think that it's like end of next year or in 3 years would be arriving. I don't think so. So I'm definitely Team LeCun here as well in terms of the actual forecasting range. Let's put it this way. I can't see it sort of crossing the threshold anytime soon.
I'm obviously open to being amazed and astounded.
Oh, yeah.
And
always.
And like we said, also maybe it's already here and it's just hiding itself very well.
That would be very intelligent.
Yeah, that would be intelligent indeed. But great. Yes.
Yeah. So, always happy to hear from the readers and listeners. Podcast@thenextweb.com. Let us know what you think. In the meantime, let's move towards something more tangible with the story that we didn't cover this week. And I wanted to highlight a new hardware release by a company called Fairphone. It is headquartered here in Amsterdam. It's actually not very far from our offices, just up towards the train station. And if you're not familiar with Fairphone, it is known mainly for its family of repairable smartphones, modular ones, basically made of ethically sourced materials. And the company was one of the pioneers, in fact, of the whole movement of ethically sourcing materials for electronics and being sustainable and things like the right to repair and so on. I actually remember going to their offices and making a video of disassembling the second generation of their smartphone that was back in 2015. So as a bonus link for this episode, I will also leave that video in the show notes. You can take a look at mostly my hands, in fact. Anyway, last week, Fairphone released a new thing, and this time it is earbuds. That is, Fairbuds, as they call them.
That's a very, very appropriate name, though.
No, I think it looks and sounds pretty good, the name. And these Fairbuds are fully modular, and they are repairable. Unlike most of other earbuds you see on the market, they are just one piece, basically. You have two earbuds, one case, and that's pretty much it.
Yes, this is true.
And to be precise, it is possible to replace 7 different ports of the device, namely the earbud battery, the silicon ring, earbud ear tips, charging case outer shell, charging case core, charging case battery, and the actual earbud in case you use it, for example, just one and not two.
That would be highly convenient for anyone like me who ends up throwing one out there.
Yeah, happened to me as well. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not a Fairphone user myself. I use a Pixel, but I do like the idea of everything being more repairable. I do like it very much, in fact. So I will probably consider Fairbuds as my next pair of earbuds when the current one finally gives up, which it seems to be on the way to. I'm not sure that I like the price tag of 149 euros, though. But then, I mean, you get the repairability and you get 3 years of warranty. So it might be just about worth it after all.
And you get, you know, the good conscience of having bought an ethically sourced material.
That's priceless.
Gadget. Yes, see, you'll sleep better at night. That's the Apple ecosystem addict.
Yeah, exactly. No, but great for Fairphone. And if you are already a Fairbuds user, let us know. I would be very interested in hearing more about the sound quality, first of all. I'm really wondering how good earbuds are they, in fact.
Absolutely. I'd love to see like an actual video review of them. So yeah. maybe we can find one somewhere.
And maybe we can get a pair and test ourselves. Mm-hmm. Now, let us move on to the learnings of this week. I promised some nerdery at the beginning, and I think this is the time. Linnea, what did you learn?
So I was wondering, I was like, is this just too much nerd and not enough tech? But I think that anyone that has had their well, fictional, although it may be, but anyone that has had their skeleton covered in a mysterious alloy known as adamantium is kind of like an augmented human, which is kind of techie.
Yeah, sure.
Also, streaming is kind of techie. So there you go. plus, I'm just very happy because I'm so ecstatic about the X-Men 97 series on Disney Plus. If you haven't seen it yet and you are a fan of the comics, please do. So I learned about Wolverine's first appearance, which was not in the X-Men, actually. So Jimmy Howlett, or Logan, actually makes his first appearance as a character in a different comic book. Can you guess which one?
I'm not a comic fan, so no, I can't really.
Well, it's one that you would know even if you weren't a comic reader. And it was in 1974, and it was in The Incredible Hulk.
Huh.
Number 181.
What
did you do there? And the Hulk is apparently in Canada, out in the wilds, and Wolverine shows up fighting a creature and then also briefly battles the Hulk. And Wolverine actually came about because Marvel thought they needed a Canadian hero to boost sales in Canada.
That's a great story.
And, well, obviously the X-Men comic was created in 1963, and then Wolverine was introduced into that part of the Marvel universe in 1975. So 1 year after he first appeared in the Hulk. Also, side fact, Stan Lee originally wanted to call the X-Men comics the Merry Mutants. Andre's face is what we call cringe. But Marvel's publisher actually shot that down.
I'm just trying to remember how the world would look like today if we had
The Merry Mutants instead of the X-Men. Yeah. So the reason for not going with that title was apparently that they believed that people wouldn't understand what mutants were. Huh. So they went with X-Men instead, with X standing for the extraordinary powers that they had.
I mean, it worked quite well for the Ninja Turtles though, right?
Well, I mean, people knew what ninjas
were. No, I mean, but they were Teenage Mutants, Ninja Turtles.
Okay,
I mean.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. Not Mary, though.
Not that Mary, no.
Although they were cute. Anyway, that's the
no, that's an interesting fact.
tangent down the world of animation. But yes, if you're a fan of the comics, do watch X-Men 97.
Will do.
Okay.
What did you learn this weekend?
Me? Okay, I was... So my learning, again, is a bit of much more in the real world than Wolverine's appearance somewhere in Canada. but so what I learned is it has to do with drone delivery. So just to set up the scene, last week I went to Brussels to attend an event by the EIC Scaling Club, which is, by the way, a great initiative that helps startups basically scale and support them through the journey, and we are one of the partners there. So I went... Yeah.
No, and some really, really interesting companies and some very cool tech happening there. Yeah. So I'm really excited to see where they go.
Yeah, the selection into the club was really, really intense, it seems. And the deep tech companies selected there, they look very impressive. So last week I went to Brussels to attend an event by the said Scaling Club. And then I talked to a great group of entrepreneurs and VCs from across Europe, mostly deep tech focused, as I said. And I also met someone from the Irish startup called Manna, which you probably know. It is a drone delivery company that's raised over 25 million euros by now, I think. And Manna's drones are already operational in Ireland, namely in the town of Oranmore on the West Coast and in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas in the US. So one question I had about drone delivery for a long time was whether most people would actually just order it once for the novelty of it and then never come back.
Which is easy to imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Right? That was like my core assumption, I would say. But it turns out that it's not quite like that, not always. And the team at Manna actually has already figured out a path that most customers take in terms of adoption of drone delivery.
I'm intrigued. What is this?
So, as they told me, it very often starts with a delivery for a kid's birthday party. And it doesn't really matter necessarily what exactly gets delivered because it's more of an activity and kids are, of course, very excited by seeing the drone that hovers over their backyard and there's a winch coming down, delivering whatever it is. So kids are happy. Fine. Within a few weeks, That order is usually followed by a coffee order on a Saturday morning. And coffee as in not the beans, but actual liquid, actual drink. So Mana delivers quite a bit of coffee, it turns out. And then after one or several coffee orders, the customer would normally move on to also order other stuff regularly.
Mm.
It is also worth mentioning, by the way, that yes, overall, coffee is the most popular, I think, product for drone delivery with Mana. I would have to double check it, but I think that is the case. People like their coffee delivered by drones.
Well, when I was in Greece last summer, you would still see little motorbikes coming with the coffee, sort of the coffee tray hanging off a device, you know, on the handle, or they would hold it in their hand and on the motorbike and delivering coffee, you know, just on the other side of town or something like that.
Wow.
So I can see that. I'm just imagining that drone delivery will be a little bit more expensive. But if you're a group of people and like a big family and you want to treat yourself on a Saturday, sure.
I think the fee is flat. It's like €5 per delivery.
Yeah.
So it doesn't
matter how much it delivers.
So because there is an obvious limitation of how much the drone can carry. Yeah. But like it always costs €5, mm-hmm. I think, at least in Europe. So, if you're like with 4, 5, 6 people, it can be okay. And yeah. I think it takes less time, in fact, than getting that delivery in a normal, traditional and conventional way of a car or a motorbike.
Yeah, I guess it would. And I'm just imagining that for whatever reason, you are not going out to get your own coffee on a Saturday morning, that it might be very convenient to have it just drop into your hand while you're lunging on your sofa in the backyard, let's say.
So let's wait until something like this is available in Amsterdam, and we will definitely try to test it and get our after lunch coffee delivered to us.
Yes, we absolutely have to do. You have a backyard, right?
Yeah, I do have a backyard, yeah.
That's it. I'm curious about their name, Mana. Is it from Mana from Heaven?
I guess, I think so. I never asked, but I always assumed that was the case.
I would imagine.
Now, let us move to today's featured interview, and this one is with Caroline Villarouge. She is the CEO at EIT Manufacturing. This will also be explained in the interview what it means, if you don't know it. But I interviewed Caroline a few weeks ago at another EIC event, that's the EIC Summit, and that was just after she had participated in the opening of the new EIT hub in the UK, which is part of the UK basically coming back into the fold of European research framework. So a big part of this conversation was focused on the cooperation between the UK and the EU when it comes to research and innovation. But of course, we discussed a whole lot more also about the EIT manufacturing initiative itself. So here is the conversation in full. Enjoy and stay tuned. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So can we start with a little bit of background about yourself? Can you tell a little bit more what you've been doing so far and what brought you to where you are now?
Sure. So I have the CEO of EIT Manufacturing, started in the job about a year ago. From a background perspective, I'm very much an industry person. I started my career in automotive industry at Nissan, European headquarters in France, then moved to Switzerland. Then I thought that I would try to something different, move to management consultancy, and was missing the industry so much and the balls and nuts so much that at some point I really wanted to go back to mechanical engineering industry, and I worked for a Swedish manufacturer called Munters, who is working in the HVAC industry. I led here a different department, different senior leadership role. And at the same time, I started to feel that I wanted to engage myself in more entrepreneurial thinking. So I engaged myself as a business angel. And also start to support some student in master in entrepreneurship from HEC Paris and Polytechnic.
That's really interesting.
That's how I ended up at some point into leading this
organization. Are you also investing in
manufacturing
related companies?
I am not right now personally investing in industrial manufacturing. EIT Manufacturing is investing quite a lot in industrial company. But this is something which through my work with EIT Manufacturing, but also personally, I'm trying to push my group of business central to invest more in, definitely.
But can you formulate in general, why did you miss manufacturing so much? Like, what's so great about it?
It's a very good question. It's something which took me a couple of years, quite a few years, I have to say, to realize is, I think since a very young age, I've always been fascinated by making things, making things with the tools, with my hands, the tangible aspect of seeing something build from zero to an actual final product is something that really always, I think from a very young age, excite me. And then my career brought me into something which I realized something I really liked from a very young age. Manufacturing and industry in general is really about building everything that is surrounding ourselves. That's the real life. Yeah. And I enjoy it.
Is there any particular category that's like closer to your heart, the closest to your heart?
Well, obviously, I started automotive industry, and automotive industry is a fascinating, complex, yet super exciting, and bring also emotion into people at the end. So that's really an industry which I will say I'm close to, and I learn from. That's where I was groomed. But talking about industry today, I think a big benchmark is automotive, and you could be applied to many different sectors in the manufacturing industries.
And how long have you been the CEO of EIT Manufacturing then?
It's been now 11 months. I'm about to blow my first candle.
So how has it been? Can you talk a little bit about like your own experience with EIT Manufacturing, but also about the organization itself? What is the mission? What are the goals? What's the vision for it?
So EIT Manufacturing, it's a public-private partnership. It's been funded, co-funded by the European Union with the European Institute of Innovation and Technology back in 2019. So we are a 5 years old organization. We do focus on education, entrepreneurial education, bringing viable innovation to the market, and then truly accelerate and support startups to grow and scale.
Right. And what's your track record has been like so far in terms of, I know, how many startups, how much funding, how do you measure yourself at all?
So today we measure ourselves by, first of all, the number of startups we're supporting. We are today supporting around 450 startups across Europe. We also measure ourselves through the number of innovation we bring to the market. So we really focus on pushing innovation out of the lab and get to the first commercialization. And here we are about 4 to 5 innovation in the last 2 years, that concrete innovation, robot, AI tools, which we succeed to bring to the market. And we also monitor ourselves by the number of students or people going through some learning journey. We train to gain the skill we need for tomorrow.
Right. Now, this is really interesting. And out of these 450 startups, what stage are they on? Is it mostly startups? Is it mostly scale-ups? Is it both?
We start from an early stage with the startup we support from the innovation project, so bringing them to the market, so in the first commercialization aspect. But we do also focus on coaching and supporting startups, which are more in a scale-up phase.
Right. And are you working with other European initiatives such as the EIC?
Of course, we do collaborate quite well with EIC in the Fast Track program. We are supporting, coaching, but also sourcing some startup into the EIC funnel. And that's something which we want to continue and reinforce.
Right. This is really interesting. And as far as I understand, most of the European programs, they have some sort of like a lifetime. Is there a lifetime for EIT and EIT Manufacturing?
So EIT Manufacturing, we are in a 2x7 years program. Now we are on year 4.
Of the first seven.
Exactly. So we have the first 7 years and then we will reassess in 27 and onward.
Okay, perfect. So you just participated in the opening of the EIT Hub in the UK, which is something I wanted to talk about. So can you first tell me how it went and what it actually meant in your opinion? What was it like?
So yes, indeed, we did open last week the hub in the UK. It was, I have to say, an important moment for the UK and the EU to really kick off this rebuilding bridges between these two ecosystems. It means quite a lot for us because in the manufacturing space, obviously, the UK is quite an important country from a manufacturing perspective, also from an innovation and an academia perspective. So building and bridging these two ecosystems is something which we truly believe will help to stimulate the innovation and also to help these different startups and innovation ecosystem to develop for the UK one toward the European Union, but also for the European ecosystem to develop further into the UK ecosystem.
And in practical terms, what does it mean to have such a hub in another country? Because there are more hubs, as far as I understand, right, that EIT has.
So part of what we call the global outreach, mm-hmm. We do have some hub outside of the European Union. We have one in the Silicon Valley in mm-hmm. San Francisco. We have one in Israel. And the one in London is going to be the third one mm-hmm. outside Europe. Practically, what does it mean is that we will have some people on the ground in the UK, making sure that we are bringing the two ecosystems into the different activity we have, mm-hmm. Such as the innovation call for proposal, which mm-hmm. is where we are providing so Horizon Europe program money into some different consortium. So English, British mm-hmm. company, university or research center could join this call from now on and benefit from this funding from Horizon Europe.
So that was not possible by them just rejoining Horizon. For that, you had to open a hub there.
The thing is, in the way EIT manufacturing is working and all the EIT knowledge innovation community is that mm-hmm. we are a European organization, but we have regional offices all over the place, because we truly believe that this is by being closer to the ecosystem that you truly bring the impact. So we have today in EIT manufacturing 6 different hubs across Europe, and then the London one will be the 7th one.
Perfect. And so, what if we look from the standpoint of a startup based in the UK, what are the new opportunities for such a startup now? What can they do like right away, basically?
What can they do right away? They can reach us. Mm-hmm. We can start to discuss bringing them into introduction with mm-hmm. the European ecosystem. Today, EIT Manufacturing, it's more than 170 partners, private partners across Europe. 60% of them are corporate mm-hmm. industry. So we can bring this connection to help them to put in place some POC, for mm-hmm. example, interaction for first commercialization. And at the same time, we can also bring them some access to finance by introducing them to European venture capital.
Right. Do you already have any requests in this first week?
What I would suggest to the ecosystem in mm-hmm. the UK, the manufacturing ecosystem in the UK, we actually have what we call a matchmaking event, mm-hmm. which is happening on the 29th and 30th of April. And I would welcome them to join. It's an online event. It's free to reach. And this is for us really the way to connect people all across Europe and now the UK.
Right. I was just wondering as well. So manufacturing in general, it's such a capital and human power intense industry, and startups are usually the companies that don't really have neither a lot of money nor a lot of people to work on the factory floor. So where do the startups come in when it comes to the manufacturing ecosystem, or what's the role that they play?
Yeah, it's true. It's not that easy to be a startup in the manufacturing industry. And why is that? Is first of all, it's a traditional industry. By the state, and it's also often an industry which is very capex intensive. Mm-hmm. So early investors are sometimes a bit, I would say, skeptical or not mm-hmm. as enthusiastic as they will be for software startups. And this is where, I mean, we intervene. This is where we bring European public money mm-hmm. to really de-risk and also make sure that the private investment is following us. Your question, what do they get from it, is really, again, mm-hmm. bringing them connection, introduction to industrial company, introduction to the financial investment, and also some other, we can guide them through the public funding mm-hmm. if they need to develop further the technology.
And do you see any particular parts of the manufacturing ecosystem where startups play the biggest role, or maybe where they can be applied to and with the most efficiency?
Well, today, obviously, the big topic are around deep tech.
Right.
Deep tech, artificial intelligence. This is something which in manufacturing we address. We have a lot of different innovation projects in that sense. I will say that space definitely is an area where we have big opportunity mm-hmm. right now. And in the future, it's going to go at a pace we can only think about.
Do you have any particular interesting examples of what you've seen recently?
What I've seen recently, I can give you an example of a startup we are today supporting and which we've been helping through different activities. The name is Chaos. It's a French startup. I'm not doing that because I'm French, but I think it's a good example of how to apply AI into the spare parts management and inventory management. Today, we have industrial manufacturers who have long-term stock. They do have parts in their inventory which are obsolete. They don't know what to do with it. It costs them a lot of money. Most of the time, they just scrap it at a certain point. And this company, this startup, is actually from a very smart way scanning the parts, identifying the part numbers, and making this part available to all industrial community across Europe. So thinking of a circular economy principle and a new revenue line for a manufacturer, these are the kind of startups we like to support, as it's taking both the technology aspect, but also the sustainability angle.
Right. Now, this is very interesting. And I also read your statement from before, from last week in the UK, and you also mentioned that you're working with the universities across the EU and the UK, opening them up to each other and the ecosystem. What does it mean in practice? What sort of work do you do with academia and commercialization?
Yeah, so academia, first of all, we do have a master program in entrepreneurship. So we try to really focus on the engineering classic, I would say, master program, and we add a layer of entrepreneurship to that to really try to bring this entrepreneurship thinking into European future minds. So master program, PhD program. Today, we have partnership with university and school all over Europe. We can, from now on, open it to UK universities. So that's an opportunity of bringing this program together. We also have different creation of content material that university or research center are contributing to create content material on deep tech, on different topics, on AI, on robotic in the manufacturing space. This content, we work with university and research center to build it, to build it and to deliver it. And here again, it's opportunity for the UK ecosystem to contribute to that building, upskilling and reskilling in Europe that we definitely need in the transformation we're going through.
Absolutely. And when you say that you have this master's and PhD program, what does it mean in practice? Do you have it like in a certain university, or do you run it yourself, or do you license this course to different universities around Europe?
We shape the program with different universities across Europe. So usually this program are across two minimum, even three different universities across Europe. And they do move 6 months in one university, 6 months in another university. And we do shape the program and the different courses with these universities.
This is great. And how do you think it's actually going on right now with commercialization of university research in Europe in general? Do you see progress? Where do you see challenges?
I think we see quite a lot of progress. Many universities today, they have their own launch startup program. They do a lot of spin-off. We work with them on a project where we really help to push this technology out of the lab. And this will go through a spin-off principle. They do focus quite a lot on it. They need some help and some support. And they're getting more and more professional into that aspect. Again, I think it is through collaboration and helping and the ecosystem building around them that we make this technology more closer to the actual industry demands, which is always a bit of a challenge for universities, making sure they do develop a technology which is answering the industrial demand.
And what do you think the main challenge right now is? what's the hardest? Is it just that students don't really think in entrepreneurial terms, or is it that the universities aren't all that willing to part with their IP on the same terms? What's it like?
I think it's a complex question. There is a bit of both. The entrepreneurial mindset is definitely something we need to continue to work on in Europe. I think when we go and have some tour toward the Atlantic and see what our colleagues in the US are, we make progress, but we still have a long way to go. So that's the first piece. Then there is an investment to consider is really making sure that we invest our money into the viable technology that we know is the technology that is going to make a difference tomorrow. So it's steering the investment and investing more Mm-hmm. I mean, we definitely in the manufacturing space. As we know, there is a lot of capex required in the first phase when you do first production line, when you invest in the machinery, and it's a space where we need much more investment if we want to be relevant tomorrow in the different value chain in Europe. So. Entrepreneurship mindset, yes, we need to continue to work on it. We need to believe in ourselves. We can do it. And also we need to really convince more the public and the private investment to come and join the party.
Right, absolutely. So to wrap it up, I wanted to ask another question about the UK and the connection that you've just reestablished. So how much do you think had we lost in the years that the UK was not a part of the Horizon scheme? And what do you think are the still main challenges to solve before we can get like fully integrated again?
I think it's a big opportunity for the UK, but it's also a big opportunity for Europe. This is a win-win-win situation. Here, I don't know how much the UK lost. I think they also focus on different program with different region across the world. So you know, investment mm-hmm. has been there. The UK government is investing in research. So I don't think anything was on hold as such. However, I'm a strong believer of collaboration and how bringing ecosystem together really bring this incremental value and innovative mind and thinking that we are all looking for when we talk about innovation. Here again, this is a 1+1=3. So truly hope that this collaboration will bring very shortly some big benefits. Activity have started already. Again, I'm inviting people to join matchmaking mm-hmm. event in the manufacturing space 29th and 30th of April. From there, we're going to build some consortium, bring some people into collaborating more. So we take it from there with some concrete action. And hopefully in the next months and years, we will start to see the first results.
Right. And do you see any more challenges to be solved in this collaboration? Or is it smooth sailing from now on?
It's not a small selling. No, yeah, I mean, full transparency. And I think we discussed it last week as well in the opening is we need to rebuild trust. Obviously, all the collaboration and work was there some years ago. We put everything on hold. We need to rebuild trust. We need to rebuild this ecosystem. This will take some time for sure, but we are ready for it. And we are very open and happy to collaborate again between the Europe and the UK.
Caroline, thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time and good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Big thanks to Caroline once again for finding the time to come on the show. And this is all we have time for in this episode of the TNW podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our show, please help us spread the word. Tell a friend or colleague about the show and follow our updates on social media. Just search for The Next Web and you will find us almost everywhere, except probably TikTok. Music and sound engineering for this podcast done by SoundPulse. Feel free to email us with any questions, suggestions, and opinions. We're always happy to hear from you at podcast@thenextweb.com. I am Andriy Degler.
And I'm Lini Algin.
Have a great week, and we're going to talk to you again next Wednesday.
Bye.
Bye-bye.